You are listening to Shakespeare Decoded, a podcast series by Shakespeare Dallas. At Shakespeare Dallas, we are asked all the time, is Shakespeare still relevant today? There are countless situations in Shakespeare's plays that could be put into the category of the human condition, something that never changes from century to century or country to country, despite all our differences in knowledge, culture, and emphasis. Shakespeare's characters experience practically every human emotion you can think of, and every human situation. The social issues of Shakespeare's day, which feature in the plays, class division, racism, sexuality, intolerance, the role and status of women, crime, war, death, disease, are still the burning issues in today's dysfunctional global society. Each episode features a different host and a unique set of panelists.
Hello and welcome to our episode 4 of Shakespeare Decoded, the podcast produced by Shakespeare Dallas. We're so excited to have you here, and this episode is called What a Noble Mind, Hamlet and Mental Health. My name is Megan Harris, and I am the Programs Associate with Shakespeare Dallas, and I have some really wonderful people here with me that I would like to introduce to you. So first, we have Emily Faith. She is a local Dallas-based teaching artist, and she's currently pursuing a master's in drama therapy. We're so excited to have her. Next, we have Seth McGill. He is a local Dallas-based actor and educator. And last but not least, we have Stormy Demerson, who is a local-based actress and artist. Thank you guys so much for being here.
Thanks, of course. Megan.
Thank you.
I'm really excited to talk to you guys about Hamlet and about mental health and sort of what you guys think, what your perspectives are, not only as artists. Emily, I know you have a really unique, more academic background, but I'd love to kind of just jump right in if you guys are all right with that. Is that cool for you?
Sounds good.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So obviously the first thing we want to sort of talk about for those that aren't as familiar with Hamlet is sort of give a rough overview of what the story is about. Seth actually played Hamlet for Shakespeare Dallas in 2019, so he may be pretty familiar with the role. You want to do it? Okay.
I mean, basically Hamlet is about a prince named Hamlet whose father is murdered by his uncle. And then his father visits him as a ghost and asks him to avenge his death. And so then the story that unfolds for the most of the play is Hamlet trying to find out the truth about his father's death and to see how people were involved or implicated that he knows, either his mother or his love, Ophelia. And then to create allies and to try and draw that truth out through all these different sorts of means that he employs throughout the show. Ultimately, he does find out the truth, but then it ends, as all tragedies do, with most people dying at the end, in the middle of all the revelation. Something like that.
Something like that. that's a great start. And certainly one of the things that we talk about is the fact that Hamlet has gone through a series of pretty difficult challenges. Not only has his father died, you know, he finds out that his father was murdered. And he was murdered by Hamlet's uncle. So his own brother. And then said brother married Hamlet's mother, which for an Elizabethan would have essentially been considered incest, because once you marry into a family, you become related. And so that's pretty traumatizing, pretty upsetting. And as Hamlet says, the funeral and the wedding were only 2 months apart, which is kind of a lot. So when we open up the play, Hamlet he's still in black, he's still in mourning. While everybody else is celebrating the wedding, he sees it more fit to continue to honor the memory of his father, who just recently passed. And he's obviously pretty angry with everybody who doesn't seem to get that. But then, of course, there's the most famous scene of this, speech of this entire play, which if anybody knows anything about Shakespeare, you've probably heard this quoted. It's the to be or not to be speech. And, you know, obviously we hear that quoted a lot, but if you're not familiar with Hamlet, it's maybe not, you don't know exactly what the context of that language is. But Stormy, would you mind sort of talking briefly about sort of what Hamlet's state of mind is during to be or not to be? What's going on? What's he talking about? What does to be or not to be even mean?
Sure. So in the to be or not to be speech, I will save my rendition of any of that. Essentially, he's depressed about what's happening. His mom is about to marry his uncle, and his father has died, and he's just at war with himself. When I hear or read the speech, it is the soliloquy. It's a suicide note is what I hear. But it's the thoughts that you have leading up to suicide. And so he's just embattled. That's always been my take. I think that the importance of this speech is that it shows the vulnerability that we all have when faced with uncertainty, things that just don't make sense, and depression. And it's interesting because Hamlet walks us through every single emotion that he has, why he has it. You know, he tells us everything that's happening and why he's upset. And often we don't get that when dealing with depression or things that may even cause us to be in that mental space.
Emily, I see you nodding your head. Do you have any thoughts about all of that?
All of it. I thought about everything. No, I think depression, Stormy mentions a couple of times, and in my research, people have given Hamlet many diagnoses: depression, borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder. And I think from a clinician standpoint, diagnoses are really helpful in knowing how to help people. Like, what is going to be the intervention? What are we going to do? How can we best support you? So putting a label on him of this is what depression is, or the people who've said this is bipolar, it can be sometimes furthering of those ideas we have where we say, well, somebody's crazy, right? Somebody's so bipolar. She's so depressed. He's so whatever. Hamlet was depressed and then he, you know, kills people and there's an instability there. That's not true for everybody with these diagnoses. So I'm so soft to use those or not quick to use those. But I think there's probably a couple of things going on, like suicidal ideation. I hadn't thought of this as a suicide note, Stormy. And so when you just said that, I'm like scouring this again, like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. Thank you for bringing that to my attention, and looking at it through that lens is really profound.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because in addition to this moment of the play, which again, like I said, is probably one of the most famous, and like Stormy and Seth and Emily have said, you know, he's wrestling with literally to be or not to be. Do I end it all? Do I just give up and say, it's too much, it's too difficult? Or do I push through, and what does that look like? But then there's also this whole other element, and I'm curious what you guys think about this, because as an actor and somebody who's read Shakespeare's plays, I'm always sort of confused by exactly what Hamlet is doing here. In addition to that moment, which in theory, because it's a soliloquy, right? Nobody else is on stage. It's played as a private moment. Now, there are some interpretations where there are characters who do hear him say this, so different interpretations, of course. But he also makes this interesting decision. You know, Seth, I think you said, you know, he's trying to find his allies and find his enemies and figure out who knows what about the death of his father. So he's sort of in this state of espionage, trying to figure things out. And so the tool that he uses for that is, and Shakespeare's language calls it him being mad, and I say that in big air quotes, or crazy, as, you know, we Americans would say. But he uses that as a tool to sort of take people off their guard and sort of investigate, but nothing that he says, you know, has any credibility because he's crazy or whatever. And I'm super curious what you guys think about that. Like, what is he doing there? Is he actually going crazy, or is he making an active decision to do that, and why, and how do we sort of reconcile that? Because to me, I think it's a really interesting example of, you know, where we culturally have to be careful about stigmatizing, right? Because I think you see the characters in the play doing that with him all the time of, oh, well, what he's saying or what he's going through doesn't actually count or matter because he's out of his mind, you know? I'm just curious if you guys have any thoughts about any of that.
Well, just to add on to be or not to be, and then if it's okay if I go into that.
Yeah, please.
So the way I sort of played that moment and the way we sort of collaborated, RP and I collaborated with it on, was a combination of, yeah, it was like a suicide proclamation. But then whenever I did the asides to the audience, I treated them as sort of this great cloud of witnesses, just like the Bible sort of mentions, we're surrounded by this great cloud of witnesses. And so then the monologue became me trying to reason with the spiritual world why I don't know if I can do the thing that the spiritual world has tasked me to do. So my father's like, avenge my death. And I'm like, I don't think I can do this. And so then I'm like, I think I have to end this. I have to die. I have to not be. And so when I went through that speech, there were three moments where the first moment I led up to almost plunging the knife into my heart. And the second sort of moment of confessing the suicide the feelings of suicide, it sort of crescendoed at me almost stabbing my neck. And then the third one was my brain. And so then each time I sort of like was trying to work myself up to the courage of doing it. And then I couldn't even do that. And like Stormy said, the identity crisis was a big part of it. I can't even muster up the courage to kill myself. I can't muster up the courage to avenge my father's death. And who am I? What am I worth, really? And so then that, all of that, I think kind of leads into this, also this descent into, we could say madness, or we can say his exploration of the undiscovered country, the unknown. He talks about the unknown. And when you stand at a void and then you go into the void, it's kind of like, when you are in the void, exploring the void, you know, as far as like this ghost and all of these things that are happening, and then this face that you put on, when you're behind the mask, you may have a mask, and the mask may be what defines your madness the most. It's just a mask of madness, but there's also a darkness that's behind that mask that you can get trapped in. There's a void in that as well, because if he's in the middle of an identity crisis and then he wears a mask, he's probably not in the best state to not become consumed by it. So it's like in that whole message of his father was poisoned, and so now he's trying to draw out the poison. And so in a sense, he becomes a little bit poisoned himself at every turn. And I think those moments, like when he's speaking with Ophelia and he says, "This is making me mad," I think he's being truthful with her there. I think he's saying, "I'm playing madness, but I'm also becoming mad," like this whole process. I mean, telling her that he doesn't love her when he really does. There's all these small little cracks and hairlines that are already in his psychological framework that I don't know that he can sustain the mask that he puts on without it breaking him.
I'm thinking too, like you, Seth, speaking from your own experience with the role, there's just this shame, like you're calling it the void, but I'm also hearing shame. And whether or not he's putting on madness or is experiencing it, this is a person who is not in control of their circumstances and takes extreme measures to be in control of their circumstances. What, I mean, the play would have been over if he was like, "Yo, sup, bro, you killed my dad. I'm telling everybody, we're going to find the proof." You know, like it would have been a whole different thing, but in an effort to regain control and regain that identity, that is not something that I would say people who like have great control of their lives are out there doing. I like the void being where shame is located.
I think also too that, Megan, I think you spoke about whether or not, in particular using, you know, air quotes, crazy and identifying someone as being insane or out of their minds, when Hamlet is, I don't know how any of us would have dealt with the circumstances that he was enduring, you know, and is it madness or is it just, you know, how do I cope with what I'm seeing, what I'm experiencing, and walking around as if it's normal?
Absolutely.
That what I'm experiencing, everyone else is participating in, and it's almost like a little Twilight Zone moment. Am I the only one who sees what's happening? And that thought in and of itself can lead to hysteria, mad. Of course, I have no clinical evidence of this, but just, I mean, how would I deal with that? You know, it's a lot. Any one of those things in and of itself, his mother marrying his uncle, his father being dead. And his mother marrying his uncle, did his uncle kill his father? And now I need to avenge my father's death by killing my uncle? And meanwhile, there's a ghost here. So it's a lot.
It is a lot. And it's almost, no, I was like, the word gaslighting keeps coming up when you just mentioned that, like, oh my gosh, he's looking around like, everyone's, this is normal. Right.
And you definitely see that from the very beginning of the play. I mean, Seth, I remember, and I would love for you to talk about this, but you made a really interesting choice when Hamlet first appears in the version that we did in 2019 of sort of what your state was. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, you made the choice to be drunk, actually, at the very top of the play. Can you talk about that, you know, speaking to sort of Hamlet's state of mind there?
Yeah, absolutely. My sort of thought was, not only was he drunk, but I think he was purposefully wearing the same clothes as the funeral and hadn't cleaned them. So I think he was drunk and stinky and stubborn. I would say petulant, you know, and spoiled. And maybe if you look at the context and see the sort of relatively the kind of world that they were in at the time, I mean, it wasn't extraordinary for those types of things to happen in royal circles. And so for that sort of treachery and those sort of things to happen between brothers when it came to a crown. So I think he started out just being very depressed and drunk, and alcohol is obviously a super depressant. So he was just, and part of it was that whenever his friend shows up, whenever Horatio shows up, he's like, hey, drink some, you know, that's what we do here, right? We just get drunk and cover up all the problems. And I think he's just despondent at the fact that everybody's just drinking and merry at this wedding. And so he was drinking ever since the funeral. So his depression, he's not drinking to be merry at the wedding. He's drinking still to hide his pain and wondering why, like, everyone around him isn't still mourning the same way. And so, yeah, that was kind of how we played the beginning. And so then this sobering moment happens when he sees the ghost. I imagine that was almost like an antidote to his drunkenness. Like, he sobered up pretty quickly. And maybe, you know, maybe I even played around with, there's this, like, this supernatural sort of atmospheric thing that sort of like shook through him, and when the ghost was commanding him to avenge his death and all of those things and telling him the truth, that it was almost like he just sobered up right away. So that became a demarcation for a little bit of the real madness that he was able to then mold and use a little bit of the real madness to fake some madness. And so that's kind of where that all clicked for me on stage and in the progression of his through line through the show.
That's super interesting, just to think about just sort of what his mental state is and what the ghost sort of does for him. And you know, I'm super curious, you know, I would love to know more about the supernatural and Shakespeare's time and what the understanding was for some of that. Because I think it, from a contemporary point of view, you can look at that ghost as being a lot of things, you know, like, obviously, you know, I know some people believe in ghosts, but we don't have a lot of evidence for that in our contemporary world. But still, the character of that ghost means so much, as far as, I think, Emily, used the buzzword of shame. But yeah, like familial ties and guilt and, you know, grief and all of these things that are pushing him. You know, and I think looking at Hamlet through the lens of mental health, to me, opens the play up in a really interesting way, because Hamlet a lot of times gets stereotyped as like, the dude who couldn't do anything, you know, like he procrastinates through the entire play and like won't get anything done. And every chance he has to do, he doesn't take it, you know, until the end. And that's boring, you know, like, why do I want to watch a dude like, you know, just have a crisis the whole time? But I think when you look at the psychological things that Hamlet is grappling with, like you said, Stormy, like, how on earth? I mean, I couldn't even begin to put myself in Hamlet's shoes, as far as how does one deal with all of those circumstances compounding at the same time, and what is your responsibility to your loved ones and to yourself and to your community and your, you know, government and all of those things that, you know, that are all resting on Hamlet's shoulders and in a very isolating way, right? I mean, like you said, everyone around him is gaslighting him. So to me, it makes the character of Hamlet much more interesting, because you realize he's actively dealing with things throughout the entire play, but a lot of it is internal and psychological, because he has to overcome, you know, trauma and all these things. To me, it makes this a much more exciting play than just like the dude who couldn't take action, you know?
I think absolutely. And something I hadn't considered, alcoholism is a whole nother, like, maybe podcast. But Seth, when you're discussing, you know, him showing up that way, it makes me think about, what were Hamlet's coping skills before SHIT hit the fan, right? If we don't develop healthy or like manageable coping skills, then something like this happens. I mean, I would say when all of these things compound, there's no healthy coping skill in the world that's like, okay, and I'm going to do my laundry and I'm not going to lash out at my girlfriend. Like, those things will probably happen under these extreme circumstances. But thinking, oh, if this was set in a time, I mean, I would say even right now, so many people, myself included, didn't have skills readily available to me. I had not practiced skills before COVID-19. So my coping was not things that were not sustainable and certainly not helpful to my mental health. That's my tangent about Hamlet. But thinking about you're exactly right, Megan. Like, how was he set up to be anything different than what he was?
Yeah, and that I think it was more of a celebration. They probably just had a lot of festive things that would happen. His father was away a lot, and I think he probably had a fun relationship with his uncle and his mother. He probably enjoyed being around all the people. I imagine he had, you know, maybe not a perfect childhood, but he had famous actors coming and doing plays to where he knew them, to where, you know, he had Yorick, who, like, just was one of the best. I mean, like, he rode his shoulders everywhere and had so much fun with Yorick. And so it seems like he had such a picturesque world, and it all abruptly stopped, like, on a dime. It really is like the end of innocence. You start seeing the people around you rather than seeing them as heroes and perfect, like perfect mother, perfect father, awesome uncle. You start seeing them as flawed. And then I think he just, that just caved in on him so quickly that there were moments in the show where I could see Hamlet reverting back to childhood with his mother, reverting back to his teenage years with Rosencrantz, or his college years, I'm sorry, reverting back to more, you know, more of his youth with the players. And so he's constantly thinking about that. So I think with the ghost, I don't think he just swallows right away that this thing's a good thing. I think he still is wondering, is this a demon? Is this some creature? Now, we debated whether or not, I mean, we played around with whether or not it should just be Hamlet to see the ghost, or if other people should, but the text is pretty clear that other people see him. But Hamlet still, even up to when he's trying to catch his uncle by having these players play out the story of the poisoning, even after that, I don't think it's until then that he really, he sees the reaction from his uncle, and he's happy and with Horatio that, hey, look, there, I got the evidence. But I think also he needed that a little bit, because I don't think he wanted to believe that his uncle was capable of that. I think he was still in denial, and I think that might explain some of his inaction or his perceived inaction, because I think, how does he say that all of these people are, his mother has betrayed his father and his uncle did that? I just don't think he's able to grasp it all directly. I think he has to sort of slowly absorb it and become a detective. And I don't think, so I think his inability to move forward might also be his ability to say, wait a second, even though I had this crazy vision and this ghost told me everything, I'm still going to try this spirit at its word and try and see what, how I, if I agree with it totally or not before I suffer the slings and arrows, I guess you could say.
One of the most interesting things that you said, Seth, is, I mean, it's so, I'm so glad that you're here to give us insight on how you portrayed Hamlet, because it's so important in understanding, you know, as actors, how we do our work, but it means that we have to also put ourselves in that position. And one of the things you said, and I'm messing it up, I'm sure, but the fact that there's a ghost that is aligning with the suspicions that he has, there's something that lives in the spirit world that is making more sense to him than what he's experiencing in reality. And that's something to contend with. It's like, okay, you know, like Megan was saying, some of us believe in ghosts, some of us don't. But wherever you sit on that scale, an apparition is an apparition, and it's not anything that you can touch. And so just by definition of what an apparition is, what do I believe? Who do I believe? Do I believe my own thoughts? And if I'm seeing a ghost, really, is it all in my head? Like, you know, even though other people see the ghost, is a ghost telling the other people things that it's telling me? You know, and what do I believe? And if I'm hearing this, I'm the only one that feels this way or has any kind of suspicions. Is it me?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think it all goes back to sort of what Emily touched on earlier of like Hamlet's isolation and the gaslighting and all of that, you know, of, you know, when your only source of information that's contrary to what you're experiencing is not a credible source, which I think is, you know, structurally what Shakespeare's doing to tell the story, right? Because if somebody that, you know, some authority, you know, a Fortinbras figure, right? Some other government official from some other nation was able to be like, I have clear proof that this, then that it would be a totally different story. You know, if it was Horatio that said, I know, I saw it happen, it would be a different story. It's the fact that it's coming from this dubious source that, like, do we even believe in that? Do we know it to be good? We don't know. So it seems to me like it throws, again, it's another thing for Hamlet to juggle, right? Psychologically, of like, what do I do with this? And, you know, is this trustworthy or not? Yeah, that's really interesting because it was one more thing for him to deal with that isn't easy.
No, I think what you're saying also, it's like it's a part of grief. He's bargaining. He's creating meaning, like, and searching for meaning. And I think that totally aligns with the stages of grief. He jumps, I think, forward and backwards a couple of times, which most of us do before we get to like the acceptance of it all, right?
Yeah. Well, in addition to Hamlet, you know, there's another character in this play who pretty famously has some really serious psychological trauma throughout the play. And of course, that's Ophelia, Hamlet's girlfriend, question mark, partner, friend. But she, you know, it's interesting because she also has her, and again, I put in giant air quotes, madness moment in Act 4, Scene 5, when everything starts crumbling down around her. Essentially, Ophelia, again, being Hamlet's girlfriend, she is told by her father, Polonius, and Claudius, who, I don't know if we've mentioned him by name yet. Claudius is Hamlet's uncle. He becomes the king of Denmark when he kills his brother, Hamlet's father. So Claudius, King Claudius. So Claudius and Polonius tell her that she has to break up with Hamlet, even though she's in love with him, because they need to see if that's the reason Hamlet's acting so quote-unquote crazy. Is it because he's so in love, you know, and if they end that relationship based on how he reacts, you know, that will tell them what he's got going on. Because, of course, Claudius, knowing that he's committed an act of murder, you know, once Hamlet starts acting really suspiciously, you know, he becomes really concerned that Hamlet may know something, right? So he forces her publicly to break up with him. They hide behind a curtain and watch and listen. There's a lot of interpretations as to whether or not Hamlet is aware that they are there, but they're not, you know, they're supposed to be hidden, right? And Ophelia has to break up with him. So that's obviously extremely upsetting. And then continuing down that road, later on, Hamlet goes to confront his mother, as Seth referred to, you know, to see, have you betrayed me? Have you betrayed my father and you know, your ex-husband? And he ends up realizing there's somebody else in the room with them. And so he assumes that it's Claudius, and he goes and stabs the curtain behind which this person is hiding. Well, it turns out it's not Claudius. It's actually Polonius, Ophelia's father. And so he kills him accidentally, of course, but he still kills him. And that, as a result of that, Ophelia pretty much falls apart because, you know, you could say that she's sort of lost everything too in her own way. But I'm super curious. So basically, all these things happen and it makes her go crazy. And so we have this Act 4, Scene 5 scene, which is the flower scene. She comes into the room and starts giving them out flowers and she's singing and she's like lost it, you know. And I'm just curious. So, you know, I guess I'll start with Emily. What sort of behaviors is she engaging with, you know, a modern perspective? And what do you think's going on with her?
I mean, I think you said it when you talked about identity. And I think, you know, we compare her and Hamlet, their grief, they've both lost fathers. But for a woman at that time, especially, like, that is, you're losing a lot more when you lose your identity. And especially, you know, I kind of see her a little bit as a pawn throughout these things where she's being told what to do. And then the guidance, I'm using air quotes for guidance, being told what to do, that's gone. I think for both of these characters, the idea of were they set up for success by their grown-ups, I don't know. Resilience, I don't know. Horrible, tragic things happening to them, yeah. For Ophelia, I see, right, depression is there. And do I think, I guess the questions in my mind were, it makes perfect sense for someone to be very, very deeply heartbroken when they've lost somebody. But for what we see, my brain goes to something else was going on before this. There was something prevention that we missed. But I'd love to hear from the actors on this.
It's interesting you say that because every time that I've read it or seen it played, I've had that thought too. It's like, what's going on with Ophelia? I mean, is there some prevention, as you said, that was missed? And was she already in a very delicate, sensitive state before, you know, this information? And was this just the thing that took her over? And to your point about her being a pawn, you know, a lot of times where has her voice been? And a lot of times when we stifle our voices or our voices have been stifled, there's a buildup inside. And at some point you have to, that buildup is going to reveal itself or it's going to show itself in some sort of form. And I think that what happens with Ophelia is that may have been, I mean, you've enlightened me today. That may have been what's part of what's going on. I mean, it's enough that her father died, but that the fact that her love killed her father, two people that are supposed to be her protectors in this time frame, you know, and in our sense of what protection would have been for women then, are gone in different ways. Her father is gone because he's just no longer going to be here. And her love is gone because he doesn't represent what he has represented to her. And what does she make of that? What is she supposed to do now?
Do we know, like, her mom is dead? Her mom's dead? Do we know that?
It's assumed. She's never really mentioned, and we never see her. So it's assumed that she's gone, but there's not any clarity on that, you know?
Adding on to you guys talking about, was there something else that was brewing before all this other stuff happened? And there is that line before Ophelia comes in where Hamlet refers to her and says, "Nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered." So in her eyes, he's saying he remembers all his sins. Well, what could that be? And so one thing we played around with was, were they sexually active before marriage? And what are the implications at that time? And he's saying, get thee to a nunnery. So he's just so abusive towards her. And then it's interesting that in the scene with the players, where they're acting out the dumb show, there is this side commentary and banter that happens between Hamlet and Claudius and Hamlet and Ophelia. And the banter with Ophelia is so lewd. He's so lewd to her. And he sort of carries along with that sort of nymph theme. He's like, he treats her lewdly in public. And so he's shaming her. And so it's part of his mask, you know, but it's also, maybe there's something else there, you know, if she betrayed him and hurt him, you know, what's the best thing he can do, or what's the most hurtful thing he could do back? Tell her he doesn't love her, and then treat her like a whore, for lack of a better word, in front of her family, you know, in front of her own father.
And Seth, can you mention in the scene, in the breakup scene where Polonius and Claudius are hiding and Ophelia is saying, you know, I have these letters and I have to break up with you. In your interpretation, just to be clear, I think you've mentioned to me before that there was an understanding in your interpretation that as Hamlet felt betrayed by Ophelia because you knew that she was sort of working with the enemy. Was that's part of the deal, right? So maybe that's right. Part of what he's going through of feeling betrayed by her and the fact that she broke up with him.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we did play it that way, to where there were times where I would direct words and lines off stage to them, in a sense, like project it or throw that out to them just to make sure that, I don't know if Hamlet was trying to tell them, I know you're there, but either way, yeah, we played it that he knew that she had conspired.
So then I think that makes it really interesting of him sort of calling her out and shaming her. And again, in the lovely gender delineated world of Elizabethan England at the time, you know, obviously your woman's honor was, you know, a big part of your value. So,
right.
You know, and I've also heard it said, and I'm just curious that this is literally just me getting nerdy and curious what you guys think. But I've also heard interpretations that it's implied that at the end of this scene, Act 4, Scene 5, she kills herself. So she drowns herself in a river. Some people say that it's accidental, some people say it's intentional, but let's, just for the sake of argument, let's just assume that she does actually kill herself intentionally. I've heard it posited that in addition to Hamlet and Ophelia being sexually active, that the reason that she kills herself, the reason that she goes mad, is because she's actually with his child. And I think Well, and I think it points out, Stormy, what you were saying about, like, because what came up in my head when you were talking about, not only was her father murdered, but he was murdered by the love of her life. I try to imagine if that's part of the given circumstances. And again, this isn't explicitly said in the play in any way. This is just an interpretation that some people have taken. How do you reconcile that, right? Because that's a whole nother level of, like, I can't have a future with somebody who has done this to me.
One thing I kicked around was, you know, she's talking about all these flowers and things and singing about them. Was she also on some sort of opiate? Was she also on some sort of drug too? Do you know, like Hamlet was super drunk after his dad died. At least that's the way I was sort of playing around with that. Was she also playing around with some sort of apothecary with the flowers and did she just drown because she fell asleep in the water or passed out in the water and was washed away? Now, that's just, we didn't kick that around in rehearsal. That's just me thinking about it.
Yeah. You know. There's so many ways to interpret it. And that's the thing that I kind of love about Shakespeare, but also makes it kind of challenging 450 years on, is trying to understand what was Shakespeare specifically trying to do and trying to imply and trying to say, because there are a lot of things that are left open for interpretation. In particular, this play, right? You get just enough information to kind of piece together where everybody's at, what's going on. But then there's a lot of things that are left open. So it's super challenging as an actor, I'm sure, to sort of take some of these things on, because, you know, you need to know very specifically what's going on, but Shakespeare doesn't give you that. So does anybody else have any other thoughts about Ophelia before we move on?
I'm still stewing on your, like, was she pregnant and what that could mean? Like, and if she did intentionally die by suicide, like, you know, her son could have been an heir. Like, all of these, my brain's going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me. I don't know that it's necessarily the right choice, and maybe different productions, you know, but it's just, that to me just adds a whole nother level. And
well, it makes me think of Lady M too, like these women who would rather, like, having a baby and their children for them is not worth, you know, power is more important than that, or death is more important than that. And then I could talk about postpartum all day long, but that's another podcast.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, no, that we're, absolutely, yeah.
Well, I also, you know, remember talking to you previously about her singing a song and being, I think, the only one in this show that sings a song, and there being a little bit of a parallel with the clown, with Shakespeare's clowns, and a lot of times the melancholy clown, maybe even, that they reveal a lot of truth, and they're sort of the one who shows the mirror to the audience, like, look at who we are. And I think Shakespeare was having us explore the situations that women were put in because of the decisions of men and because of things they couldn't control. And just like Hamlet couldn't control a lot, being a son and not being the uncle that gained the crown. There was so much he couldn't control, but it, you know, like, and it's not just that, but it's even more magnified with the woman character, like Juliet and Romeo and Juliet and Ophelia. It's this, I think he really was exploring the helplessness and the tragedy of what was being done to these women in his time. I think he was aware of it. At least it seems that way to me.
That's a really great point. You know, it's interesting. When we say the word clown, obviously there's a very certain contemporary image that comes up. But Seth, you mentioned the melancholy clown. There's sort of this trope in Shakespeare of the more comedic characters, or the quote-unquote clowns, often would be the most truthful characters in the play. And Hamlet as a tragedy doesn't, I mean, you have the players, which are kind of, but for the most part, you don't have a lot of comedy in this direct, clear, you know, commedia dell'arte style comedy in this play. But it's really interesting, Seth, that you bring up, yeah, that Ophelia sort of functions as this, like, mouth of truth. You know, in the song that she sings and the sort of coded language that she uses, she's very clearly calling the people around her out for the way that they've treated her and tortured her, and psychologically in some ways. And that's really interesting because, you know, and again, it goes back to mental health and all of that. I think, you know, it's like Ophelia going through all of this reaches this sort of clairvoyance. And I think the characters around her are quick to dismiss what she has to say as crazy, as she's raving, she doesn't know what she's talking about. But if you really lend an ear, she's actually right. And so to me, I think that's kind of interesting from Shakespeare's time perspective, just because there wasn't a lot of understanding about mental health or trauma or, you know, like post-traumatic stress or those kinds of things. And that, you know, that it may actually lend her more credence than anything else. Her eyes have sort of been opened in a way. And it kind of goes back to, I guess, what you said about Hamlet, Seth, which is the same thing where he sort of starts, the innocence around him starts to crumble, and he starts to see things as they really are, much to his own chagrin, right? Because he doesn't want to believe that his parents and his family and his friends are betraying him, but they are, you know, and you have to kind of go through this to sort of realize that, and as much as we want to resist it, you know. So I guess the last bit of our conversation, I want to sort of open it back up to talk to you guys as artists and as actors about, you know, what do we do with all of this, right? When we're embodying a role like this, whether it's Ophelia, whether it's Hamlet, you know, that is dealing with a lot psychologically, obviously that takes a lot in us to sort of approach those kinds of roles. And you know, there's always this sort of big question that I think gets asked a lot in actor circles is, does acting operate as therapy? You know, is it a way to sort of deal with your own emotions or your own trauma? I'm curious if you guys want to answer that question, what your thoughts are on that.
I think that it is. I think it is. It's therapy, but it's at the same time, I'm speaking for myself, there have been roles that I prepared for that required me to address some things that I hadn't addressed. Part of my process is in portraying any character. In becoming a character, I have to invest part of myself or else it's just not real for me. And I don't think it's going to be real for anybody else. So in doing so, I have to find, as we do, substitutions, but not just substitutions for a moment, but being able to relate to a period in my life that aligns with whatever the character, who the character is and what they're going through. And that means going through my own personal therapy for that character. I can't run from it or else it won't be authentic. So, I mean, yeah, it's therapeutic, it's cleansing, but it's also very real. Like you have to be able to swallow whatever jagged pills come your way in order to tell a story that could help somebody else or, you know, that opens up a vision in a different way.
Yeah, Emily, do you want to speak to any of that from your point of view?
Oh yeah, I do. Stormy, I think the jagged pill's right. And you said something that reminds me of therapists say, we can't take our clients further than we've gone ourselves. And I think some young actors, or when I was a young actor, it was like, okay, I'm going to be depressed and I'm going to drink all the time and I'm going to, you know, experience what my actor is experiencing. But I don't think that's actually truth. I think what I'm hearing from you, Stormy, is this is there is wells and depths inside of me of my own story that this resonates with. And for me to be able to portray this in the way that I would like to portray it, I'm going to have to address that. And I think addressing it is very in like acknowledgement of what our own personal trauma or story is really the healthful way to move forward if we're drawing on our personal experiences and then knowing how to take care of ourselves after that, right? I've spoken with this group before a little bit on, we spend so much time being trained on how to get into character and then really quite little time on the exit from this character and how we take care of ourselves in post, because our bodies don't just shut off, right? We can shut off our mind like, boop, I'm not Hamlet anymore, but our body's still, it's still going. It's still feeling that. We have this somatic memory that I think it's really important to take care of.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. The post is sometimes immediately off the stage, immediately. I mean, it's, you know, we all can attest that sometimes you have to switch, turn on the dime and get back into character that may be laughing in your next scene. And so that transition is a whole other mental and emotional transition. And so you or me as the person, after the curtain's down and the lights go off and the show closes, like you said, you still have that experience and you're still walking around with those emotions that you dealt with and the process that you went through, and it lives in our bodies. And so we just have to make sure, I know one of the things I do is I kind of live with it a little bit, you know, and not even on purpose. Sometimes I want to shake some stuff off because I'm like, whoa, you know, that was heavy. There have been times where I'm like, you know, a couple weeks after I was a little depressed, you know, because it requires so much investment sometimes, more than at moments that I realize that I invested in. And it's like, okay, I gotta shake this off because I have to actually live and do laundry and stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think you made an interesting point about process, about what happens in the process of finding the truth with your character, because we go from process to product. You know, we go from the process of building that character in rehearsals and finding the texture and finding the truth of who that character is and letting them live and be as real as we can possibly make them. And then we go to the reality of an 8-show schedule in a week, you know, and then it's just process. And it becomes a little bit more, you know, like you said, you go from one scene to the next. It becomes very manic. It can become very bipolar in a sense. Like you can feel, you know, as you get going and have your sort of script laid out, like a symphony, once you get that product going, you kind of feel like you lose your humanity then a little bit. It's like you gain it all in rehearsal and you have all these discoveries. I've had some crazy discoveries in rehearsals. And when I first started theater, it was a massive amount of therapy for me. Like, I used it to escape. I had a crazy home life. I mean, obviously, I had a wonderful mother, but my father was not there. He was a very bad alcoholic. And so when it came to doing Hamlet, dealing with that, you know, I had a very clear moment in my life where my father was there and then he was gone pretty much forever until he passed. And so, you know, you go there and you explore that in the rehearsal process and you're digging stuff up. And anytime you dig stuff up, you're going to find other things you weren't expecting. And so I used theater a lot for therapy, but there's definitely a clear point in my life where I realized, okay, look, theater is great for discovering things about myself and potentially becoming a better person in the process, but I can't always expect that from it because sometimes it's just about me giving to the audience and me becoming and serving the story. And then I have to find a way to where I don't need that therapy or that resolution from that role. I kind of was using it more as a fix to get to moments of healing. And, I did have to find a balance. It all sort of came to a head in college because then you're thinking of it as a profession and something that you could sustain every day. And it's not sustainable to open up and dig up bodies every time. So, yeah. I really sympathize and empathize with Hollywood actors that just have to go in and they don't have the necessarily, like what we have as stage actors is we have the benefit of being surrounded by a community while we're working on this show and we're dealing with it from beginning to end and we're talking with actors backstage. But a lot of film actors, they just show up and they have to go there right away. And so I can see how that can be. How they might rely on maybe unhealthy means to do that or maybe even, like we say, become a little bit too method to get there because they don't have the luxury of just sitting in it with a group, with a community like we do with stage plays.
That's a really great point. It's a really great point. And especially with, the community is, like you said, Seth, I mean, we have that, as colleagues, but there's also the energy that we have that we get from, the audience. You know, it really is a communal, the whole process is a communal experience. And energy is real. All of that is, I guess it's kind of, I look at theater as like, it's a very healthy way for all of us to get to a happier place, even if it's not a happy story, you know?
You end up having to forgive villains in your life, especially when you play a villain. But then when you're in a show with villains, you kind of have to forgive them a little bit too, at least to move forward. It's not like you excuse what they do or you accept their behavior, but you do have to find forgiveness in the middle of all that.
Yeah. And I think you also understand it a little different, because a villain wasn't always a villain.
Right.
They weren't
in kindergarten talking about,
right?
Oh, I can't wait till I get to, cheat all these people out of their retirement.
Right.
Then nobody's doing that when they're five. I mean, maybe one kid in like a million.
Like, oh, that makes sense.
This is where I like plug drama therapy so hard. I do talk therapy with clients, but I think drama therapy in particular is all these things that you're talking about where we intentional, it's not, you're talking about dead bodies. Like hopefully at some time, like the dead bodies stop showing up so frequently. Like that's the goal of therapy is that we've kind of hit these dead bodies and maybe there's like a finger left or like a toe, but we've hit the dead bodies. And so at that point you're in your profession, like, well, I'm kind of healed from this. Like I've kind of healed for this. The part of drama therapy that I like to use with clients, whether they're actors or regular folks, businessmen, as I like to say, is the same thing is true. They're being witnessed the way that an audience witnesses us. There is a sense of community. There is enrolling. There is embodying. There is transforming your own story the way that we use text to. It's totally magical. And everyone, like I said, plug, everyone seek out a drama therapist. There's two of us in Dallas.
Yeah, I think that's really wise. I do have one example, one story I want to share. So I was in this, when I was 15, you know, I was in this acting troupe, and we would go to all these schools, and we would do improv mixed with, like, scripted sketches about different issues teens face. Well, because the director and sort of the people in charge knew my background, they knew I was dealing with a father with alcoholism. They gave me the monologue where this kid's talking about his dad being an alcoholic. And I remember when I first did that monologue for the group and I first memorized it, I was just in tears. And I was like, but the more I did it, the less I could cry. And so then that, I don't know, I don't know where this, what, why, what, where this story is going, but you as a drama therapist, it's interesting to me that I would really connect with it. And it was a cathartic moment. And I was like, it really was my truth. This character, it was just me talking. But then, you know, after, I don't know, a whole year of doing it, I kind of was like, hey, could we have somebody else do that monologue? I just don't even... It's almost more painful to me that it doesn't make me cry anymore and I can't find tears.
Oh my gosh. I have so much, there's mixed feelings happening with that story, Seth. Like, who were these grown-ups who thought this was a good idea? But then maybe.
Right, that's why I'm not going to mention the.
Right, but no, but then maybe it was. Maybe there was this like long plan here, being able to acknowledge and work through something and work through our pain. Because I think we live in a society that is very quick to be like, yeah, like my dad died, but tell me about you, right? So like they were asking you to sit in it a little bit longer. My feelings aside about that, you're exactly right. You work through it and then you don't cry about it anymore. And then we pick a new monologue for you about how you can't cry about your dead dad, right? Like then we keep going.
Right, right.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so, so much for joining us. Thank you, those that are listening. Emily, Faith, Seth McGill, Stormy Dimmerson, we have had such a great time today. I really, really appreciate you guys sharing your thoughts and sharing your artistry and your expertise. So thank you so much for listening to this fourth episode of Shakespeare Decoded. Please check us out when you can. We have an episode dropping every month. We really, really appreciate you guys giving us a listen, and we'll see you around real soon.
Thank you for listening to Shakespeare Decoded, presented by Shakespeare Dallas. For more information about Shakespeare Dallas, visit shakespeare-dallas.org.